So I'd like to start by thanking Simon Grant, actually, for the invitation to be here. He couldn't be here today, but thanks also to Rowan and Ravi for that kind introduction and the ANU for the kind invitation to be here today. It really is an honour to present the annual Sir Leslie Melville Lecture at my alma mater. And as I was suggesting earlier this evening, I actually had my first economics lecture in this very room, sitting down the front, and was very impressed with the lecturer on the day, Ian Harper, who I have the pleasure of seeing quite regularly at the RBA board these days. So Melville was, as Robbie said, was the first economist at the Reserve Bank of Australia, and he established the precursor of what is now Economic Group, and that's responsible for macroeconomic analysis, forecasting and policy advice. I spent much of my career there, including as the RBA's chief economist. I also helped to set up the Financial Stability Department with Phil Lowe, and for some years now I have been overseeing Financial Markets Group. So today what I hope to do is cover some of the key issues that have garnered my attention in those roles. I'm going to start with an observation that despite significant structural differences across economies, including some relatively unique features of the Australian financial system, there's no evidence that monetary policy is stronger in Australia than in other advanced economies. Now, that finding may appear to be somewhat at odds with the comparatively large stock of variable mortgage rate debt that carried by Australian households, and thus their exposure to significant interest rate risk. But I think this apparent conflict can be reconciled when one considers the various ways in which that interest rate risk is managed in Australia, as well as the effects of some other important channels of the transmission of monetary policy. So after stepping through some of the arguments in more detail, I'm going to also finish off with some observations on forward guidance and some of the reasons why it's been used somewhat differently at the RBA, at least up till now, than many other central banks. Let me start here with this summary. So one way to judge the overall potency of monetary policy is to compare its effects across different economies on aggregates like GDP and inflation using different macroeconomic models. So if we do that for a range of models for several different advanced economies, it suggests that the effect of monetary policy is neither faster nor more potent in Australia than elsewhere. So central estimates from RBA models of how much GDP and inflation decline in response to an unanticipated increase in policy rates sit near estimates generated by models used by other central banks in the US, in the euro area, the UK, Canada and Sweden. While the central estimates of the effect on inflation are a little bit lower for some models of the US compared with estimates from other economies, these modest differences should be considered within the context of what are quite wide confidence intervals around each estimate, and they're not shown here. These are just the central estimates of a range of models. So at the same time, however, key structural differences are likely to underpin some variation in the nature and strength of some specific channels of transmission across economies. And one key feature that I'd like to highlight that sets Australia apart is the prominence of variable rate debt. So I'll turn to that now. In Australia, most private sector debt is subject to variable interest rates. Even the fixed rate debt that's out there tends to be fixed for pretty short periods of time compared with other economies. At the other extreme, of course, most mortgage debt in the US is fixed for 30-year terms, and large corporations, they issue a lot of fixed rate bonds for reasonably long terms as well. So this chart shows you that the share of Australian mortgages that are fixed at fixed rates is really quite modest compared to others. It's been around 20% over the past two decades, and most of that is fixed for 2 years or less. Similarly, a larger share of business debt in Australia is at variable rates than in the US. It's common, in common with most advanced economies, Australian firms borrow mostly from the banks. Around 90% of those loans are undertaken at variable rates. And while that's comparable to other the share of variable rate business loans provided by large US banks, bank loans are only a small share of US corporate debt, as you can see here. Large US firms obtain much of their debt by issuing bonds, typically at fixed rates, and when they issue those bonds, they typically issue them with an average tenor of around 11 years. In comparison, since 2022, large Australian businesses have issued fixed rate bonds with a slightly shorter average tenor of around 9 years, but they're not the main game for Australian businesses. We turn to interest rate risk. Households with sizable variable rate debts, they face significant interest rate risk compared with other households. So a rise in interest rates, that quickly is going to reduce their disposable incomes of those households and their capacity to consume, to save, to invest. So this creates budget pressures. It can lead to some households into financial distress and in the extreme, leave them unable to service their debts. The same is true for businesses with sizable variable rate debts. But in what follows, I'm going to focus my attention on household mortgages because they constitute a larger share of total debt than most other economies and set Australia's financial system apart from many others. So the prominence of mortgages at variable rates in Australia, that suggests that interest rate risk can manifest itself much more quickly here than in most other advanced economies. Indeed, over recent years, some of the most rapid increases in average outstanding mortgage rates are shown in red here. Some of those have occurred in Australia, and Norway is another one that stands out because it also has a high share of variable rate mortgage debt. And this increase is despite the fact that policy rates were rising by less in these economies compared with many other advanced economies. So debt levels for households are also relatively high in Australia, at least as a proportion of their incomes, as you can see here. And when we combine that significant rise in outstanding mortgage rates with the high levels of debt, that's led required mortgage payments, which is shown here as interest plus scheduled principal. That's led them to increase quite a bit by 2.5 percentage points of total household disposable income since the RBA started raising rates. The increase as a share, so that's a share of total household disposable income. We don't have a good measure of just mortgage holders' income, but if we did, the increase in the share of just those with a mortgage relative to their incomes would be much larger still. And these mortgage payments have reached record highs in Australia. Now, despite the substantial increase in mortgage payments, there's been little increase in acute financial distress among borrowers. And you could see that here because mortgage arrears have risen, but they remain low and they're actually at quite similar levels in Australia and the US. And that's despite the significant rise in required mortgage payments in Australia. The low levels of defaults in both economies partly reflects the large savings buffers that households had built up during the pandemic, as well as the fact that we've had relatively benign labour market conditions because unemployment tends to be a very strong predictor of mortgage arrears. As I'll outline in just a minute, financial distress has also been contained in part by the way that interest rate exposures of Australian mortgage holders are managed by the banks, overseen by the regulators, as well as by the borrowers themselves. And in short, all of those things contribute to borrowers having buffers that can lessen the burden of adjustment in the face of a rise in interest rates. Now, banks account for interest rate risk when they setting their lending policies, and APRA ensures that the banks maintain prudent lending standards. So when a bank is trying to determine how much to lend to a borrower that shows up, They must assess that borrower's ability to service their mortgage at an interest rate that's 300 basis points above the current level and still meeting their basic living expenses. So that buffer recognises risk associated with rate increases, but other risks as well, such as to the borrower's income, or perhaps the borrower might have unexpected spending that comes along. Borrowers themselves play a very key role in managing their own interest rate risk. And that really starts with their decision on how much to borrow from the bank. So the bank makes an offer, but you don't have to borrow as much as the bank is willing to offer you. And indeed, historically, only a pretty small share of borrowers new borrowers took out loans that were close to the value of the maximums on offer. Just for an example, in 2022, only around 15% of new owner-occupiers borrowed more than 80% of their maximum assessed capacity. So this share is likely to have increased since 2022 because of interest rate increases, because of house prices going up, and because of declines in real incomes. So for all those same reasons, borrowers, they're struggling to get a mortgage. Indeed, the median deposit has increased noticeably for all types of borrowers over recent years, as you can see in the lower panel here, particularly for first-home buyers. And while the first-home buyer share of new loans is actually a bit above average of late, the so-called bank of mum and dad, I think, is playing increasingly a role here. Now, once Australians have a mortgage, one of the things they do is they tend to reduce their interest rate risk by paying down their loans much more quickly than required. And they do this by accumulating funds in either an offset or a redraw account. And those accounts are readily available in Australia for variable rate loans. And they provide a very highly liquid form of saving, and it's got a favourable rate of return because the interest saved on balances in those accounts is tax-free. So currently those extra payments amount in the stock of those amount to about 20% of the total value of housing credit. So existing borrowers, they can respond to rising interest rates and the associated increases in required mortgage payments in several ways. Some borrowers may tap into existing savings. Indeed, if you look at the top panel here, it shows the share of borrowers that are making persistent withdrawals from their offset and redraw accounts started to go up above the range from prior years in 2022 as rates increased, and then stayed up in 23 and 2024. Despite that, so some are taking out more, taking out from their stocks of these extra savings, but despite that, borrowers overall continued to add to these accounts at a similar rate to before the pandemic. And as a result of that, the distribution of those savings buffers, when we express them as a share of minimum scheduled payments, that's not changed much since 2020, despite borrowers' minimum scheduled payments having increased by 45%. So some households may also reduce their savings rates for a time, and you can see that in the top left panel here. So the aggregate savings rate for households declined as interest rates increased and broader cost of living pressures ate into households' real incomes. Although some of that decline, of course, just reflected a normalisation coming back to lower savings rates as the effect of the pandemic wore off. At the same time, however, higher interest rates provide an incentive to save more. So some borrowers may reduce the extent of their discretionary consumption and even increase their rate of savings. Other borrowers may have limited options other than to reduce consumption as required mortgage payments increase. And while aggregate household consumption, particularly of discretionary items, has been weak for some time, as you can see this top right-hand panel, there's no timely and comprehensive data available on consumption by different household types. But what we can do is we can look at spending data from some of the large banks, and that just provides a rough guide. And it shows, a little hard to see here in the bottom left-hand panel, but trust me, it shows that the growth of spending in nominal terms at least has declined for all types of borrowers since mid-2022, but it's been weaker still for borrowers and renters compared for those that own their own homes outright. The other thing that can happen is borrowers can take on extra work to manage higher mortgage payments. And indeed, some work that is yet to come out from the bank but will do soon shows that borrowers with the highest ratio of mortgage payments to income in 2021, before rates started to go up, they've found more work over the past 3 years than other groups. And that's contributing to the strong rise in labour force participation over recent years. Now, lenders can help borrowers manage temporary periods of financial stress. They can defer payments for a while, perhaps charge just interest only for a time. They might lengthen out the term of a loan. Many lenders have had to improve their hardship arrangements after a review by ASIC. And this included identifying stress and setting up hardship arrangements before borrowers fall behind on their mortgages. Borrowers, though, who are just experiencing persistent difficulties servicing their mortgages and with no further option to adjust their finances, they may decide to sell their homes. Our liaison with lenders suggests that while more households are making that very difficult decision, it is less costly financially than otherwise, given the low share of mortgages currently in negative equity. And that's helped, of course, by rising house prices. Now, I focus mostly on households in this discussion because their exposures are quite different in Australia than in many other economies. But businesses are also facing interest rate risk. Recent increases in interest rates, they've largely passed through to small business loans. Pass-through has been less for listed companies owing to their use of longer-term fixed-rate debt and interest rate hedges. For many Australian businesses, the effect of higher interest rates has been mitigated by what were pretty strong financial positions as monetary policy was being tightened, including cash buffers that were noticeably above pre-pandemic levels. And while many companies, company insolvencies have increased over the tightening phase of monetary policy, this largely reflects factors beyond the direct effects of higher interest rates. And finally here, it's worth emphasising that the Reserve Bank Board is attuned to interest rate risk, the burden of adjustment being experienced by households and businesses with sizeable debts. And Australians more broadly have had to constrain their spending during the period of elevated inflation, including those people who rent and those without debt. While the Board's aware of variation in the circumstances facing different households, it of course only has one instrument, the cash rate target, to achieve its inflation and employment objectives. Now, the effect of interest rates on cash flows and the behaviour of indebted households receives extensive attention in Australia. Indeed, I've given it a lot of attention up till now. But it's really only one side of the cash flow channel, and that channel in turn is only one of the channels of the monetary policy transmission. So let me just briefly talk about the cash flow channel of monetary policy in its entirety. The other side of the cash flow channel is the effect of interest rates on the incomes of households and businesses that have net asset positions. So when interest rates rise, they're going to receive more interest income on deposits on other interest-bearing assets. As interest rates rose from 2022, deposit rates in Australia actually responded noticeably, with about 80% of the increase in the cash rate passed through quickly to deposits, and that was much greater here in Australia than in many other advanced economies. Because Australian households hold more debt than interest-sensitive assets, the net effect, though, of higher interest rates has been to reduce household cash flows. Household net interest income, shown here in the solid line, that's declined by about 1.2% of household disposable income since early 2022. Now, while that overall effect sort of appears modest, right, It's important to recognise that borrowers' marginal propensity to consume, generally, larger than it is for savers. So even this modest change in household sector cash flows can have an effect, a noticeable impact on household consumption. But let me turn now to some of the other channels of monetary policy transmission. So while the cash flow channel may be stronger in Australia than it is in many other economies, estimates from what the RBA calls its Martin model suggest that the cash flow channel of monetary policy is not actually the strongest part of the transmission mechanism in Australia. So what are the other channels? Well, they're referred to as a savings investment channel, credit channel, asset price or the wealth channel if you like, and the exchange rate channel. Again, differences in economic structures, including household and corporate balance sheets, are likely to affect the relative strength of these different transmission channels across economies. Now, the savings investment channel, or the intertemporal channel as some call it, operates through the opportunity cost of borrowing or foregoing savings to finance new investment, to fund consumption. And because savings and investment behaviour should be guided by what the average real interest rate is likely to be over the life of the relevant asset or liability, the opportunity cost should not vary according to whether or not the interest rate on a loan is fixed or variable. I just want to explore something that people often don't think about in the US context. Fixed rate lending in some cases can actually amplify or dampen the effect of monetary policy on some elements of spending and investment. For example, most existing US mortgage holders with long-term fixed rates, they were entirely protected from the effects, at least in terms of their mortgage, of rising interest rates. But at the same time, it became very unattractive for an existing borrower with a low fixed rate to move house, because if they moved house, they have to refinance at a much higher rate. And this adverse effect on housing turnover and all the associated economic activity that's associated with that implies lower investment, lower consumption than otherwise in the US. So such a consideration, that's not relevant for Australia, right? Because borrowers on variable mortgage rates or short-term fixed rates, that doesn't affect them. But it is important to note, of course, new housing investment is quite sensitive to changes in interest rates in Australia. Differences in industrial structures may also matter for the strength of the savings investment channel. Changes to interest rates can have strong effects on the demand for durable consumption and capital goods, so cars, furniture, electronics, plant and equipment used by businesses, for example. And that's because households and businesses have considerable discretion about the timing of those purchases. In Australia, production of durable goods is lower than in many other advanced economies, as you can see in this chart. More of any given change in the demand for durable goods in Australia associated with a change in interest rates is reflected in a change in imports, with less of an effect on the demand for factors of production like labour. Instead, a larger share of Australian production is accounted for by commodities, and the demand for that is less sensitive to interest rates. There are aspects of other channels of monetary policy transmission that are likely to vary across economies. For example, the structure of household and business balance sheets can influence how responsive consumption and investment decisions are to asset prices or the willingness of banks to lend, and both of those things can change with interest rates. So Australians have a lot of their savings tied up in compulsory super. Hence, they've got a higher share of their financial assets in pension funds than many other advanced economies, and more than twice the US share. So consequently, Australians have a lower share of their financial wealth in directly held securities. And we'd expect the transmission of monetary policy via asset prices to be just a bit stronger for directly held securities which households can sell or borrow against to fund spending, than assets which are locked up until retirement. The median listed company, just focusing on large companies in Australia, has a higher share of assets held in cash. You can see that on the left-hand side of this chart, and lower leverage than the median firm in many other advanced economies. And all else equal, that's going to reduce their vulnerability to a rise in interest rates. With access to internal funds, they're less likely to cut back on investment if lenders are less willing to extend credit in response to a period of higher rates. So that's a weakening of the credit channel. Time this evening doesn't allow me for a detailed treatment of the exchange rate channel. The strength of that channel depends, amongst other things, on the nature and goods and services that an economy trades, the level of foreign currency liabilities exposed to exchange rate movements, and so on. It is an important channel, though, for Australia, as implied, indeed, again, by estimates from our Martin model, and it's also an important channel for other small open economies. I want to turn now to the topic of forward guidance and the central bank reaction function. And I'll finish on this topic. So the first stage of monetary policy transmission, that describes how the overnight rate, the cash rate in Australia, passes through to other interest rates further out the yield curve. And then those rates, in turn, are going to depend, amongst other things, on the expectation of future short rates. The yield curve, in turn, influences a broader range of financial conditions, including yields on corporate debt, other asset prices, and the exchange rate. And the spending and investment decisions of businesses and households, which are going to influence aggregate demand and inflation, those decisions will depend not just on the near-term rates that they face, but also the path of future rates that they expect. So the effect of any given change in the overnight rate was going to depend on the implication of that change for the path of overnight rates out into the future. And that can be influenced by central banks in a couple of ways. First, they could provide information about the central bank's reaction function. So how's it likely to respond to changing economic circumstances so as to best achieve its inflation and employment goals? And second way it can do it is by providing guidance on what the policymaker at the central bank sees as the likely path of future interest rates. So information on the central bank's reaction function and its forward guidance on the likely path of rates can also help to anchor inflation expectations. Now, central banks provide, these days at least, the public and markets with very extensive information on the economic outlook, what guides their monetary policy decisions, and some information on the likely path of rates. But exactly how they do that varies across central banks. I'm just going to step through some of those differences with a focus on the approaches that the RBA has used. Just to preface these remarks, though, I'd note a couple of things. First, the results I presented at the very outset on the similarity in the effects of changes in policy rates on aggregate demand and inflation, they implicitly suggest that despite these different approaches, including on forward guidance, that monetary policy effectiveness has been broadly comparable across advanced central banks. And second, I want to note, of course, there are two types of forward guidance on interest rates. Under the much stronger form, a central bank actually commits to keep interest rates at or close to the effective lower bound during extremely adverse circumstances. The RBA's review of its pandemic experience, that noted the difficulty of overlaying what was initially state-based commitment with an inflexible and quite long time-based element, and then pairing it with the 3-year government bond yield target. But that pandemic episode has been discussed at length. That's not what I'm going over in terms of forward guidance here tonight. Instead, in what follows, I'm going to consider only forward guidance that provides some sort of information about the likely path for the policy rate. And it's worth clarifying that forward guidance can also shed some light on the central bank's reaction function. And indeed, I would argue that this was the case, for example, following the August 2024 decision of the Reserve Bank Board. The Governor's media conference and the minutes thereafter noted that, in contrast to the market path for the cash rate, which had shifted quite a bit lower over the days leading into that meeting, the Board thought it was unlikely the cash rate would be reduced in the short term based on the information it had to hand. And that reflected concerns that inflation may not return to the target in a reasonable time, which has remained the Board's highest priority. As I'll note below, though, in just a minute, there's going to be some other ways to convey the reaction function more directly. So outside of that pandemic episode, the RBA's guidance has tended to be such that it's provided less frequently, it's in less explicit and more qualitative terms, and it covers shorter terms than other central banks. So, for example, policymakers from the central banks of the US, New Zealand, Sweden, and Norway, for some time now, they've been providing their views on the appropriate path of policy rates or the likely path of policy rates going out to 3 years. So I've heard several arguments for the approach that the Reserve Bank's taken over the years. Let me just step through them, and they're here on the slide. One is that more specific guidance may be taken by at least some people to be a commitment to a particular path of rates. The argument is that if a different path were taken, even in response to a change or an unexpected change in circumstances, it might damage the central bank's credibility. Now, this may be more likely in Australia, given the very intense focus, as I've already suggested, that there is on monetary policy that stems from the prominence of variable rate mortgages. And while the RBA's experience with strong time-based forward guidance during the pandemic provided evidence somewhat in support of this argument, other central banks haven't found this to be a concern when pursuing more standard forward guidance. The Norges Bank, for example, in Norway is particularly relevant here because most mortgages in Norway are also at variable rates. So that's one argument. A second argument... excuse me. A second argument is that market participants are likely to be more forgiving, at least than households and businesses, when a central bank's guidance doesn't come to pass. But more important for them is to understand the central bank's reaction function. Indeed, a former colleague of mine and Deputy Governor Guy DeBell, he argued that if the reaction function is sufficiently clear, forward guidance does not obviously have any large additional benefit and runs the risk of just adding noise or sowing confusion. In other words, efforts to clarify the reaction function can be a substitute for providing forward guidance. This could be achieved by consistently explaining the logic of the board's decisions, what they're looking for to guide future decisions. More generally, laying out expectations for the economy, explaining decisions, that's important for transparency and accountability that are the cornerstones of credibility. Now, another approach gaining attention is to use scenarios to convey how monetary policy might respond in different circumstances. Now, while scenarios can help convey the reaction function, they need to be based on the policymaker's preferences. Results that are just based solely on models are not sufficient since they're estimated with imprecision, and they reflect typical behaviour of policymakers in the past, whereas the board's preferences and even their mandate can evolve over time, including as the composition of the board changes. And that brings me to a third argument, which is about the nature of the Reserve Bank Board. Because 6 of the 9 members are part-time, it may be a bit more difficult for them to provide the sort of guidance provided by full-time policymakers who typically benefit from macro training and, most importantly, extensive support from staff. A fourth argument, another argument I've heard against near-term guidance, is there's a degree of agreement among the board members of the need, at least for an imminent change, then rather than provide forward guidance to that effect, why not just change rates now? So that's the just do it approach. And fifth, I think this is a question that's at least worth just a bit further investigation. And that is whether or not differences in the channels of monetary policy transmission have implications for forward guidance. So, in particular, because a large share of funding in Australia is priced off the very short end of the yield curve, it may be that forward guidance beyond that near term may have a more limited role to play than in other economies, particularly the US, where a lot of funding is priced off the longer end of the yield curve. Now, to be clear, that's not an argument against forward guidance in Australia, just that it may be somewhat less useful than in an economy like the US. Differences in two transmission channels of monetary policy support that argument. First is the cash flow channel of monetary policy in Australia. It's stronger than it is in the US, even if it's not the dominant channel in Australia. And second, the credit channel in Australia, as I've suggested, depends on the very short end of the yield curve, right? Because an assessment of a borrower's ability to service a loan is based on current interest rates plus a buffer, but it's the current interest rate that matters. By contrast, serviceability depends on the longer rates for a much larger share of lending in the US. Not all of their lending there is at the long end, but a much larger share. However, other channels of transmission depend on longer run expectations of rates in Australia. So that would imply a potential role for forward guidance. In particular, the savings investment channel, as I've suggested earlier, that depends on longer run expectations and should be invariant to the structure of finance in an economy. And similarly, the Australian dollar exchange rate is responsive to interest rates out along the curve, as is the case for exchange rates in other advanced economies. So let me conclude and just draw a few things together. So as I've suggested this evening, a key characteristic of the Australian financial system is the prominence of variable rate mortgage debt. And while not unique, it does set Australia apart from financial systems in many other advanced economies. And one consequence of that is that Australian borrowers are exposed to considerable interest rate risk. Indeed, mortgage arrears rates in Australia are trending up, following the large rise in required mortgage payments. Even so, arrears rates here remain low and are at similar levels to those in economies with much more fixed rate lending. And I think that outcome reflects several features of the Australian mortgage market that collectively leave most borrowers with buffers that one way or another help them to manage through a period of higher rates. That's been the case through the recent episode, although many borrowers have struggled in the face of rising interest rates over the past 2 years or so, and household spending more broadly has weakened noticeably. This influence of monetary policy on the cash flows and behaviour of variable rate borrowers receives a lot of attention in Australia, but it's important to remember it's only one of the channels of monetary policy. And there's no evidence that when we put them all together, that monetary policy overall is more, there's no evidence it's more potent in Australia than in other advanced economies. Further study of the efficacy, though, of these different channels, particularly cross-country ones, I think would be an interesting area for further research. And outside the pandemic episode, the RBA has tended to provide forward guidance that's more infrequent. It's short-term, it's qualitative, more so than other central banks. I've outlined some of the arguments for this, but I think it'd be worth reviewing the RBA's approach to forward guidance from time to time, including to consider other ways the RBA may clarify the nature of its reaction function. One thing I hope you take away from this evening, though, is that any such review should carefully account for the features of Australia's financial system that set it apart from other economies. So don't just take research off the shelf from the US because it may not apply. And finally, it bears repeating that all advanced economy central banks provide extensive information about the outlook, their reaction functions that guide the public and markets to form views about the future path of monetary policy. And central banks may be more or less explicit about that guidance, but as is the case with the aggregate transition of monetary policy, I think while the internal mechanisms might differ a bit, the overall effects can be quite similar. So thank you. I look forward to a few of your questions.
Thank you, Chris. I'll run the Q&A.
Sure, that's great. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chris, for a sweeping overview of the Australian financial system and monetary policy. One of the wonderful aspects of these events, of course, is that you get a chance to ask questions of people that you perhaps, under different circumstances, wouldn't be able to. So we'll have about 20 minutes for Q&A. If you can just briefly identify yourself and then ask a short and succinct question, and hopefully we'll get through as many as possible. For those of you who are wondering, my name is Timo Henkel. I'm also a faculty member of the Research School of Economics here, colleague of Rabi's and Rowan. I know Bob is always going to ask a question, so he is my fallback option if he remains quiet for too long. Rabi, would you like to ask a question?
Thanks, Chris. So my understanding then is you've got Australia, Norway. You've got a dominant transmission mechanism goes through households. Households, basically, many people know that. I would suggest that households who are making decisions based on forward guidance, if they're making decisions based on forward guidance, likely don't even know that every first Tuesday of most months you set rates. And they're not going to be, I wouldn't think that they're going to have an Alex Joyner or somebody like that telling them a reaction function is. Mm-hmm. Does that influence the way we would think would be an optimal RBA board, given it's households that are in first order affected? Mm-hmm. Does that influence, in your mind, the way we think? Would the RBA board then be something more representative, something that would provide competence to households rather than macroeconomists? Mm. We're basically looking at reaction functions and trying to figure out what type of guidance would transmit the best, the most accurate reaction function.
Yes, quite a bit in there, Robbie. I think, even in the US, they know even less about the Fed's decisions. When our decisions happen, especially nowadays, the governor gets up in front of a pack of the media. She usually is on all the commercial stations, on radio, in the press. Of course, that's not the only way people get their news. In the US, that just doesn't happen. I think there still is a really important role, and most of forward guidance probably is focusing not on the individuals in the economy who aren't necessarily that well informed about these things, or they have a temporary attention to them, but markets that then translate them into what's the rate on the term deposit at a bank for 2 or 3 years or 6 months or whatever it may be. What's the rate on a bond, a corporate or a long-term, a government bond that someone who has money might buy one of those. What are the sticker rates for a household that's about to go and borrow variable rate versus, say, a 1, 2, or 3 year fixed term loan in Australia? So I think it is really important to recognise, I think, as you suggest, there's a limitation in how much the general populace are going to absorb from this. Which is one argument why the central bank doesn't need to necessarily speak to them, and what my former colleague Guy Debelle said, speak to the markets, not necessarily through forward guidance, but by having a clear and well-understood reaction function. And then the markets can do that interpretation that's quite important.
Any other questions?
A couple here.
Keep in order. So far end over there, over there, and then we'll get Bob over there.
If I keep my answers long enough, Bob will have to ask me one of his really hard questions on the side. Don't worry, Bob. We'll get to you.
You established in your talk that essentially the effect size of interest rates is the same across Australia and the US, despite the very different composition of our mortgage markets. If Australia were to adopt a secondary mortgage market, which is normally, as I understand it, given as the reason why the US has such a large share of fixed rate mortgages, So Australia would introduce a bail equivalent of a Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Mm-hmm. Do you think that would have an impact on the effect of our cash rate monetary policy, or do you think it would simply change the way of transmission by which it affects the economy?
Well, again, I think the results, and I call them out, and there are others who have studied using our own model, these sort of trying to weigh up the contributions of these different transmission channels overall. Even though I, like other Australians, focus a lot on the cash flow channel in my talk this evening, it's actually one of the smaller contributors to the overall transmission. So if we're changing that a bit, it might not make much difference. I'm not convinced it's all about Fannie and Freddie in the US. I think partly they've come about for various reasons, but the US, one reason why really long fixed rate mortgages are very attractive in the US, apart from that it protects households from interest rates, but remember they have to pay a margin. Someone has to cover that interest rate risk on the other side. So it's not free sort of insurance for that mortgage holder. But one of the reasons is because of the tax system. Your own home mortgage is tax deductible in the US, so you don't want to pay it off fast. Right? So a fixed rate suits that. It's not true in Australia. Your own mortgage is not tax deductible, so you do want to pay that off quite quickly. And that's why we have these offset and redraw accounts. That's why people, if they fix, they tend not to fix them for too long because they like to be able to pay that down. And they're in some ways self-insuring against interest rate risk, right? If you do that over a long period of time and you get ahead of the mortgage after a couple of years, many households are able to do that, you can absorb a lot of the interest rate risk and you don't have to pay someone else to do it for you.
Another question over here.
Is there a disproportionate effect of tightening monetary policy on those of lower income? And if there is, how do we balance the wider objective of our inflation target with the needs of lower income people?
It's a good question and it's been looked at. Over a period of time, I guess the first thing is I would emphasise when you're sort of thinking about, say, the burden of interest rate, higher interest rates, directly I'm not sure that lower income people pay that because the lowest of the low income households typically don't have, not only do they not have a mortgage, they don't even qualify for a credit card perhaps, the lowest of the low income households. The other thing we know is that lower income households find it much more difficult to protect themselves against inflation for various reasons, partly because of the assets they hold. If they don't have hold housing or they don't hold equities, they suffer quite a bit there. So I think that's one thing. And then, I think monetary policy is quite focused, one, on inflation, which penalises everyone, but I would argue penalises those on lower incomes more. It also focuses very much on employment, and a lack of employment is usually going to penalise those in society who have the least income and the most to lose.
Chris, can you put up the first slide?
So many slides.
You're the first one.
Yeah, I'll get there. That one.
No, no, you're very first.
That one, sorry.
Okay. So, I like all the bits and pieces of the talk, but I sort of lost the structure. So, well, I just look at this picture, and I want to draw a slightly different conclusion. So I look at this picture and I see the RBA, I see the Fed, and I see other central banks. And if I understand it rightly, you subject all these country models to the same shock, interest rate shock. The thing that really strikes you about that is, let's look at how there's something about Australia, looking at these, probably interpreted this way, that means we get very little output changes. Is that how I interpret it?
No, so look, I think...
What does it mean, the variance is small?
Yeah, look, I think it's tricky, Bob, and it's because we're not comparing, it's not quite an apples and apples comparison. It's a little bit an apples and orange comparison. And so what do I mean by that? So the blue range is the range that is given by different central estimates of different models, and we don't have many that we've thrown in for Australia. And they happen to sit quite close to each other. The US has more, and then the other central banks we've done a bit of a cheat on because I bundle them together so the graph doesn't spread right out. And I've got quite a few different ones. They're not too far away from each other, but there are some models which are outliers, which why you get a higher and a lower end. The so central black points aren't that far apart, is the key point.
So let me interpret it the way I want to interpret it.
Sure, okay. Go ahead.
I'll ask the question. Let's suppose I thought that the RBA output effect was -0.4, mm-hmm. and let me suppose that the other central banks was around about -0.8. Right? And then I take the midpoints of inflation, and I get the same sort of thing, that other central banks are much more effective on inflation than we are. So the question I wanted to ask then was, I want to say that this looks as though monetary policy is less effective, especially regarding the output, than other things, rather than all the same. And then the second question that I want to ask is, if that was true, what does that imply about two questions? Question number one is, suppose we wanted to make monetary policy more effective, then you would go through each one of your propositions and you'd say, if I change this, I could do that, blah, blah, blah. And the second question is, if it's true that monetary policy is less effective, what does that imply for the balance between monetary policy and, say, fiscal policy? That is, if it's true that monetary policy was less effective, then it suggests that in Australia you want to put other things being equal, mm-hmm. more emphasis on the fiscal. Or alternatively, you were trying to beef up.
Oh, I'll do my best, Bob. I feel like I'm back in one of your excellent study sessions where we'd sit around your office and pose lots of complex questions. But I guess what I'm asserting in the paper, but not showing particularly well in the graph because of the way it's constructed, is these differences aren't so great, and part of what looks visually to be quite different, you're suggesting there might be one effect, let's say, in one of the other symbols.
I'm suggesting this graph sets up entirely differently.
Yeah. But I'm just trying to dissuade you from that, but I'll entertain your point later in a sec. But if you... you're wanting to pick, say, one of the more extreme ends on output, let's for example, on one of the other central banks, and you picked a 0.8. But that central bank might have two models, and one model might give you a -0.8, and the other model might be at the top end of it, right? And so because I've got more models in there, more economies in there, it's spanning quite a bit. So that's a little bit of it. Let me try a different way. Yeah, let me try and suggest a different way of thinking about it, though, which is how I first came to this, and then we went and looked at the models. If you look over a period of time, even in this episode, the differences in the volatility of inflation and output haven't been so tremendous across many economies, unless they've gone and had a financial crisis. That's a bit different. And the amplitude of the policy tool has not been that different either. So if the shocks have been similar and the policy therefore has been responding in a similar way, you're sort of going to say the effectiveness of that policy is similar across central banks. So that's a different way of thinking about it.
You don't need a central bank, you just follow everybody?
No. No, I mean, it might suggest the shocks are common, or, and we're not talking about shocks always being at the same time, and then there are some really big shocks where it's really important, right, particularly in, say, the GFC. And we're a small open economy, so big shocks offshore matter a lot for us, so we're responding often in kind. So I think that's... I'm not sure that you can go and sort of play with the channels and engineer the economy to be quite different. I mean, I would argue just that monetary policy has been similarly effective overall across these economies, but they're facing different economies. And again, it's like somehow underneath the hood, everything runs a bit differently. And the engines aren't all exactly the same, but they basically get you to where you need to get in about the same time. Of course, the other thing central banks are doing all the time is trying to get a lot of feedback. So when they're changing rates, they're looking at the effect of these, and they're looking back in the past, and they're trying to come to judgments whether I need to do a little bit more or a little bit less. But it's often, yeah, it's often just said in Australia, and it's been asserted by people, you know, because of the cash flow channel, monetary policy just hits that much harder. Well, it does hit some households hard, but they manage it okay. And then there are these other channels. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for finding my most confusing graph.
Got one more question there.
Thanks. Chris, I just had one question. You mentioned Norway earlier, and please correct me if I'm misconstruing your comments earlier, but you mentioned that similar composition in terms of variable rate mortgage or a high proportion, but also using forward guidance, which had a significant amount of backlash here, but you seem to indicate that less of that had occurred in Norway. Was there a quantitative reason for that, in the sense that it was a more conservative thing, or is it something about the Australian obsession?
It's a good question, and when I was sort of writing this, I sort of came to Norway a bit late in the piece and added in some of the charts late. And I did wonder that same question. I'm quite familiar with the US economy, and having lived there over the years, familiar with the way they respond or don't respond, and the general public don't know when the Fed meets and what they've done, in a way that's not true here. I'm not sure if that's the case in Norway. The comment was the Norwegian central bank doesn't think it's a problem for their credibility. And it has been argued here that it could be a problem for ours, and that may well be so. So, yeah, it's a good question. Are they as obsessed as we are about all things to do with variable rate mortgages?
Got another question here.
Hi. In the US, there's some discussion about whether the central bank actually knows more about the economic market. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of combined with a discussion about the forward guidance. So I'm wondering, how does RBA perceive itself? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you can discuss it with, combined with your discussion with the forward guidance, will be excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and a former colleague at the central bank, Peter Tulip, and others looked at this exact sort of question. And I believe part of the answer is that central banks, and we're the same, aren't that much better forecasters than anyone else. There's no real secret source they have anymore. Maybe in the past, when data was that much harder to come by and that much less timely, they had some readings that might have been advantageous. That doesn't seem to be the case. So when you compare our forecasts to things like consensus economic forecasts, we're not that much better or worse than the sort of consensus forecasts for GDP. I think it turns out we were slightly better on inflation particularly in the near term. So for some reason, we do seem to have good insights there. Again, that might disappear over time as there's more and more timely data provided on inflation. So I don't think it's the case of knowing more and therefore we can benefit everyone if we get our forward guidance out there. But forward guidance can still play a role, and I think some central banks use forward guidance as well to help inform people about their reaction function. And as my colleague Guy Debelle used to argue, it's the reaction function is really key. Thank you.
We've got time for maybe one or two more questions.
I'm not going to be very academically rigorous here, so feel free to kind of throw the baby out of the bathwater if you want. But there's been it felt as though, at least, there was a bit of talk throughout COVID and the like that monetary and fiscal policy went opposite directions. There also appears to be a bit of talk in the US of the Fed losing some of its neutrality. How important do you think central bank neutrality is?
Well, central bank independence, I guess, I think it is very important. And I think it's been incredibly beneficial in helping to anchor inflation for a long period of time. And then inflation wasn't anchored. Arguably, there's some really big shocks. Arguably, policymakers, both fiscal and monetary, not just here, but around the world, didn't anticipate just how quickly we'd come out of COVID and how much stimulus was in the system, including piles of saving that many households and businesses were sitting on and very stimulatory interest rates. But monetary policy tends to be more responsive, and it responded fairly quickly, and fiscal policy has taken many different paths around the world. And a lot of the influence, not all, but a lot of the influence, the reason why we had higher inflation was supply shocks, which were persistent, but not that persistent, and some of them have sort of come out of the system. But I think monetary policy independence is really important. I think that's widely recognised, because one of the reasons why inflation was able to come down more quickly, you could argue, is because inflation expectations were reasonably well anchored. And you could see that if you looked at wage outcomes in Australia, because when inflation was pretty high, right, a lot of enterprise bargaining agreements are multiple year ones. So they'll make an agreement for 2 or 3 years, but they'll specify a different rate. And so when inflation was really high, often that they were looking for a high rate and got a high rate in that first year, but in subsequent years there was a recognition inflation would be coming down, just as we said it would, just as we others were forecasting, and so those wage outcomes were lower. There were lots of those sorts of behaviours evident around the world, and I think anchoring inflation expectations is critical, and monetary policy independence is important for that.
It's time for one more quick question, if anyone still would like to get one in. Okay, one last final question over there, please, and then we'll wrap up.
So, if we think that the cash flow channel is quite weak, then given the social understanding that lots of people suffer when mortgage rates go up, doesn't this effectively argue that from a policy perspective, we should want something more like fixed rates? Because if it's not actually helping monetary policy and it's causing lots of people hurt, then either lots of people aren't hurting and we should just say that, like, man on the street is wrong, or we're doing something that's quite costly to people for not a lot of monetary policy benefit?
Yeah, maybe, but I think this has been thought of more in the US, where they have fixed rates and they point out the cost over the life of a mortgage of paying someone else for the insurance in fixing your rate. Because it's not for free, especially in the US, because you can also refinance and get lower rates. But when rates go up, no one refinances, as I suggested, to get a higher rate. And so there's a premium that someone in the market who's taking on that burden of providing that insurance for you in fixing your rate for 30 years is charging you. So I think you have to sort of weigh off these different costs. And I guess what I'm suggesting here is Australian households, for various reasons, turn out to be self-insurers. But when they can see a bargain, right? Many of them were very savvy and got very low rates when the banks offered low fixed rates, partly out of our policies during the pandemic. So would we be better off with fixed rates? Maybe, but we don't know because they're not on offer here, right? You can get them for 2-3 years, but we don't have an institution set up, as was suggested earlier, like in the US, to provide 30-year mortgages, but they're set up partly because of the tax issue. Tax treatment of the mortgage is very different.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming and for some nice probing questions. Mm-hmm. And of course, thank you, Chris, for delivering the lecture.